Okay. Council, are you ready? We'll call up our case today, Jamali v. State Commissioner of Insurance.
Good morning. I'm John Sandberg. I'm with Lewis Brisbane, Vice President Smith. Also at council table is Christopher Januzzi. He's not admitted, but he's a Pennsylvania lawyer who, as a courtesy, I was hoping he could sit at council table. He's not appearing, but his firm started this process with Mr. Jamali 7 years ago. And he's here to observe.
Okay, that's fine. Yes.
Morning, Your Honors. Kyle Ewing on behalf of the respondents, the Nevada Commissioner of Insurance, and Cantillo and Bennett as the special deputy receiver.
Okay, very good. Counsel, come on up. And would you like to reserve any time?
Your Honor, I also have a courtesy to ask. My hearing aid battery died on the way to court.
Okay, well.
My hearing aid battery died. So if you could please yell at me, good morning, Your Honor.
We will.
So please yell at me. That would be very helpful.
No worries.
So good morning, everybody. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, and I'll keep an eye out for the yellow light, and I'll use that as a signal to be quiet and sit down. So I've got 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, first of all, thank you for setting this for oral argument. It's a pleasure to be here. My first appearance in this court, and it is a pleasure, and it's an honor to be here. I'm here for Mr. Jamali, obviously. His journey started about 7 years ago on January 22nd, 2018. As you know from the record, he was asleep in a big rig that crashed in South Carolina. The driver died. Mr. Jamali was grievously injured. Now, I'm going to offer this presentation in terms of a bit of a timeline. I'll walk through the timeline, and it becomes significant in March of 2023 for reasons that we'll get to. In any event, the consequence of this collision is that the truck, which was operated by Cargo Transportation, went off the road. It was driven by a fellow named Antoine Dramu. I think I'm pronouncing his name incorrectly. Antoine died, and Mr. Jamali was injured. And that was on January 22nd, 2018. A few weeks later, on February 8, 2018, Carl Januzzi filed a workers' comp claim. And that, of course, everything I'm mentioning is in the record, by the way. And I can give you Bates citations if you need
them. Can you give me the citation to that specifically? Because I think there was some as to whether Carl Januzzi actually filed the workers' compensation claim else on his behalf.
He did.
Or if it was even filed.
You'll recall that there was a motion to enter the actual comp claim into the record. It was denied without prejudice. But the claim itself was filed. There's no dispute. A workers' comp claim was filed. That's not in dispute. That's in the record. The May 10, 2022 letter denying the claim refers to the cargo transportation files that do reflect that a comp claim was filed. That is not in dispute. A comp claim was filed. Now, there is a document which was a sister document to the claim, which was the response of cargo transportation, claiming in the response that Mr. Jamali was not an employee, that he was an independent contractor. The court ruled that that cannot be entered into the record on appeal, but the receiver has the document. But it's the date that's important. And there is no dispute that in the receiver's record, there is no record of a comp lien or a subrogation claim ever having been made by the carrier that the claim was made to. And I'll loop back around to that in a moment. But I just want to get the benchmark.
Counsel, is that required by the policy exclusion, though?
Once again, Justice Bell?
Is it required by the policy exclusion that there is actually a worker's comp claim that is accepted because the language of the policy is may be held liable?
You know, I have to apologize with the echo. If Justice Paraguay, could you repeat the question? I'm having trouble with the echo.
Linda, your question, Linda, again?
It was the policy says may be held liable. It does not seem to require that a worker's compensation claim actually occur, like that there is actually acceptance.
Right. That's exactly it. There was never a comp award. And I'll come to that in a moment, but I just want to get through the dates very quickly. So in any event, between February of 2018, really the first thing that occurred is that in February of 2019, the receivership was filed, liquidation order was entered.
Counsel, I think we're all familiar with the timeline. If we could focus on the legal issues, you have about 7 minutes.
You focus on the legal issues? Justice Bell indicated we're pretty familiar with the timeline,
okay,
but you don't have a lot of time, so we want to really hear what you have
here,
to say.
Here it is. The receiver is a fiduciary of the court, and the receiver is not an adversary, as a fiduciary. At the time that Judge Alf decided to adopt as her ruling the determination by the special deputy receiver that the comp claim precluded this claim, information was available and actually in the record, and the record on appeal, that a judgment had been entered in a South Carolina Court of General Jurisdiction for personal injuries of Mr. Jamali. That is in the record. It is not in dispute. And in fact, it's at internal Bates number, Jamali 589. So comp is an exclusive remedy. That judgment could not have been entered if there was a comp claim. An employee cannot get a third party judgment against the against an employer.
But I'm sorry, but the judgment was against the driver.
Correct. Now that's an excellent point. The driver, the truck wasn't stolen. The guy was driving it, whether he was an employee or an independent contractor. He was driving it with the permission of the owner of the truck, which is Cargo. Cargo is insured by Spirit. So on the, this is really the point. On the face of the claim, it is a valid claim for injuries which were inflicted by an authorized driver on an insured vehicle. The receiver is taking the position by adopting the May 2022 letter of the special deputy receiver that the comp claim was for an employee and therefore this particular claim should not be honored. It is in the record, and the receiver's lawyer keeps pointing out and arguing there's nothing in the record to establish that Mr. Jamali was in fact not an employee. I dispute that, Your Honor. The judgment that was entered in South Carolina could not have been entered because comp is an exclusive remedy if Mr. Jamali was in fact an employee. The question has also been raised in this proceeding that there is some type of effort to circumvent or create a false record that Mr. Jamali, even though he was an employee, is prosecuting this claim. What the receiver had in hand is a judgment that could not have been entered if Mr. Jamali was an employee. Now, in the receiver's records, is there a subrogation claim by a comp carrier? Mr. Jamali's meds were over $400,000. If there was a comp claim that resulted in an award, that's the interesting issue here. There's no evidence of a comp award. There's no subrogation claim. There's no lien on the judgment that was provided to the receiver before Judge Alf heard in, I think it was June of 2023. Prior to that hearing, the judgment was entered as a supplement to the claim. So the essence of this appeal is what discretion this court should afford to a receiver that had in hand in the form of the South Carolina judgment that could not have been issued if Mr. Jamali was an employee of the insured entity. That's evidence in the record that Mr. Jamali was not an employee. It's as if the truck went off the road and hit a pedestrian.
Was the issue of whether Mr. Jamali was an employee, was that litigated in South Carolina?
Was that what, Your Honor?
Did the parties litigate whether he was an employee in South Carolina?
Well, our position is that the record has evidence establishing he was not an employee of Cargo, that he was an independent contractor. And the two documents, Exhibits A and B, to our motion to include them in the record, There is, and the receiver, here's the point, the receiver's a fiduciary. The receiver has the documents confirming that Cargo's lawyer stated in the comp proceeding that Mr. Jamali was not an employee and in fact was an independent contractor. But the evidence, the receiver keeps saying there's no evidence in the record that he was not an employee. The judgment itself establishes that absent a fraud on the court by counsel, there's no evidence of that, Mr. Jamali could not have obtained a personal injury judgment against the authorized driver of the truck.
It was a default judgment, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And in the record, there are findings of fact in the South Carolina proceeding that recite the facts of the accident. Now, there is, to concede the point, nothing in that record saying that he was not an employee. There's no statement of the negative. But the evidence that is in this record on appeal and the documents that the receiver, and this is part of the point that I'd like to make, the receivership is still open. This is not a case where you have A sues B, the case is closed upon the result, now it's on appeal, and if the appellant wins, it goes back and reopens the case. The receiver is a fiduciary of the court and has a duty to disclose information and consider the claims as a fiduciary, not as an adversary. The receiver, as we stand here today, has those exhibits, the claim and the response by the employer, and must consider those in good faith. The receiver is taking and persists in the position that Mr. Jamali filed a comp claim, ignoring the fact that there was never apparently a comp award. Let's say Mr. Jamali applied to Congress for relief. So what?
All right. There so, is, counsel, that gets back to my question. Does there have to be a comp award when we look at the exclusion in the policy?
Yes, that's our position, that the policy is not...
Because it says may be held liable. It does not say held liable.
Well, if those are the four corners of the policy, I don't have it in front of me, that's what it says. But if there is, at this stage of the receivership's proceeding, which is still an open proceeding, and the time to make a comp claim by or a subrogation claim by a comp carrier has expired years ago. So at the time of the 2 weeks following the accident, there was, in fact, a comp claim. There's no dispute. But the issue here is on the face of the claim itself, especially with the supplement that was filed just prior to Judge Alf considering the receiver's position. The receiver was in possession of a judgment that could not have been entered if Mr. Jamali was an employee. And if he's not an employee, which it's like turning a blind eye to the simple reality that in the Supreme Court record, whether it's considered part of the record on appeal from what Judge Alf considered, the receiver knows and is about to stand here and take the position, I presume, that on the face of it, simply because of the claim, the policy may have been exposed. Our position is very simple. Mr. Jamali has a claim that on its face is valid. There's evidence in the record in the form of the South Carolina judgment which proves Mr. Jamali could not have been an employee. And that's why our position is that the receiver, if there was a comp award or a subrogation claim or a lien on the judgment, that would be in the receiver's records.
Mr.
The position
Sammer?
That
Mr.
was
Sammer?
Offered... I'm sorry.
I don't know if you heard the buzzer, but you got 2 minutes left. So if you want to retain any of your rebuttal time, I don't mean to... Mess you up.
Justice Stiglitz, thank you. I'm going to shut up and sit down. I'll save my 2 minutes.
Thank you.
But that's the essence of it, that it's not simply the filing of the claim. That's an event that is irrelevant for the determination of the receiver. I'll be quiet now. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'd like to start with a simple fact, which is that the words independent contractor did not appear in any of the briefing below. They were not said at oral argument. The fact dispute over whether Mr. Jamali was in fact an employee is something that was raised on appeal for the first time.
in the opening brief. And as Mr. Sandberg pointed out, we, in the brief, referenced the fact that there were no record sites to establish that Mr. Hamale was not an employee. At oral argument today, Mr. Sandberg focused on the default judgment. Your Honors asked some good questions about that. I think, first of all, the fact that it's a default judgment matters a lot on its face. It was not litigated. I think Justice Bell asked whether the issue of his employment was litigated. Not only was it not litigated, but it doesn't appear in that default judgment. It simply wasn't an issue that the court found whether or not there was anyone to defend it. And to the point that Mr. Sandberg raises, that that award could not have been granted had there been a workers' comp claim because that's exclusive, that issue was not litigated. There was no one from cargo there. There was no one from the deceased there to make those arguments. And I guess he's suggesting that the district court did some kind of gatekeeping function, but there's no evidence to expect that, and there's no reason to think that if someone applied for a default judgment and there was no one there to point out that this was properly a workers' comp claim, that the district court would have raised that argument on its own. Perhaps more importantly, in this context, the statute here deals with default judgments, and this issue was not briefed, representing the receiver, we deal with these issues a lot. So I have the statute. It's NRS 696B.450, subsection 3. And there's two issues with the default judgment that Mr. Hamale is using. First, it was entered after the liquidation order. And the statute that I just provided says, no judgment against such an insured taken after the date of entry of the liquidation order shall be considered in the liquidation proceedings as evidence of liability or of the amount of damages. That same section goes on to continue that a default judgment, even had it been obtained prior to the liquidation order, which it was not here, is not conclusive evidence. It's at best some evidence. But in any event, excuse me.
I'm so sorry. Could we go to the language of the policy? Because there are some things there that I find a little confusing, like who is the insured's insurer? And what does may be held liable mean?
Thank you, Your Honor. As to who is the insured, in the receiver's notice of claim determination, and I'm just trying to find the exact language. I believe the insurer is called accidental and occupational injury. And that's it. The respondent's appendix, page 41, is the notice of claim determination where the SDR stated that the Spirit insured, so that's cargo is who the receiver was referring to, submitted a claim to its accident and occupational injury insurance carrier. I believe that's the name of the insurance company, but there's nothing in the record to clarify that. But I think it's clear from sort of the overall structure of the policy and the way the exclusions are phrased and then numbered and listed out that it's referring to any insurer other than Spirit for the purposes of this policy, which clearly is not supplying workers' comp insurance, and that's why it's excluded. And Spirit did not supply any workers' compensation insurance here. And whether or not cargo actually supplied any is not relevant under the persuasive authority from other jurisdictions. And in particular, the Gear Auto case that we cited, which is 2012 U.S. District Court Lexus 69775, has a lot of discussion and collects a lot of cases. And the language in that policy was substantively identical. It may be word for word identical, but there's no substantive difference. And whether or not an award was actually obtained is not relevant, according to the case law that was canvassed by that court. Whether or not the employer even maintained an insurance policy is not relevant. And in that case, It was sort of an unusual case because the Gear Auto had an insurance policy, and the owner, it would appear, took on some kind of security role for himself and ended up getting shot in the foot in his attempt to do security, and then sued his own company for workers' comp. And well, the lawsuit that in the case is a deck relief action between the insurer, and he argued that his workers' comp insurance should pay for that, and they argued that the workers' compensation He argued that his commercial general liability carrier, similar to Spirit here, should be covering his injuries. And they invoked the same workers' comp exclusion that we did here. And they found that even though he was...
What is the ultimate consequence to... Let's assume employee here and leave the independent contractor bit aside for a second. But what is the consequence to the employee then? They don't have a remedy in workers' comp and they don't have a remedy with private insurance, right? That seems a little troubling from a policy perspective.
I don't think that's exactly right, Your Honor, because I think they do have a remedy in workers' comp. They have a remedy against Cargo. Now, they may not be able to collect on a judgment if they obtain it, if Cargo did not purchase the insurance it was required to. But Gear Auto and I believe one of the other cases we cited that discusses that workers' compensation has sort of preempted the area of employer liability. That doesn't mean that Cargo is not liable. Why Mr. Hamale, did not choose to file an action against Cargo instead of just its employee, I'm not sure. But if he was injured in the scope of his employment, and I would add while we're on that there is a document, it's at our appendix, page 21, submitted with Mr. Hamale's proof of claim, where he says that he was an employee and his injuries were obtained in the course of his employment. If that's the case, then Cargo is liable. And the Gear Auto case also has a good discussion, and it's at pages, get you a citation, Your Honor. It's at page 8 about commercial general liability and how that type of insurance is really meant to protect third parties that are not covered by the workers' compensation scheme, because it is the employer that is ultimately liable for any injuries obtained in the course of employment. And they should have insurance under the relevant statutes in most jurisdictions, and this wasn't briefed, so I don't know the ins and outs of all the Pennsylvania rules. But at the end of the day, they are liable for that, and there is a remedy. It's simply not through this insurance policy, which is intended to cover third parties. And Mr. Hamale is essentially asserting a first-party complaint. And even if there were evidence in the record that he were an independent contractor, the language in the policy is not specific to just workers' compensation. It mentions disability, unemployment, and any similar loss. So there are a lot of ways that, had this been litigated, Mr. Hamale may have been able to obtain a reward based on a first-party type benefit. But to try to make a claim against a third-party insurer is simply not where his remedy is available. And again, this, because the argument wasn't raised below, we didn't get into any of this. But there are challenges, even by independent contractors, who can say, hey, you may call me an independent contractor and you may pay me like one, and we both may tell the IRS that I'm one, but that doesn't mean that for the purposes of employment law, he is in fact an independent contractor. There's a whole set of analyses to determine whether they're an employee or not, and that was simply never litigated here. We do know that he was driving on behalf of Spirit and was apparently, or excuse me, Cargo, his employer, and was apparently being directed by them. These are employee-like roles. And so even if there were evidence, and I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but the independent contractor issue just was not raised in the district court. And we repeatedly in briefs, in pretty much every brief below, in the notice of claim determination and at oral argument, Ms. Hendricks, my colleague who gave that argument, all mentioned that it was undisputed that he was an employee, and that was never contested below at any point. And from our opening brief to our reply brief to the oral argument, no question about that until the opening brief before this court. But even had he been an independent contractor, there's still, and Your Honor asked Mr. Sandberg about the may language. It's that he may be liable. And again, I keep referring to the Gear Auto case. It really kind of canvassed the law on this, so it covers a lot of the issues here. And they, you know, specifically, and they cite to other courts, have held that whether or not he can ultimately recover is not the question. It's whether there may be liability and whether this is really the type of claim that lends itself to a workers' compensation claim. I'd like to briefly address Mr. Sandberg's comments about the receiver being a fiduciary and these items being in the record. We didn't have the additional documents that he put into the record or asked this court to put into the record, which was denied. But I'd like to point out that there were over 1,400 claimants in this, and there's nothing in the statute that says the receiver has to go out and do an independent investigation. The receiver did, in this case, through a third party that he brought on, do a pretty thorough investigation of all of these claims, but he's not required to go out and find everything. And it's, in fact, the claimant who is required to prove up his claim, and that's NRS 696B.330, and he's required to do so by affidavit and by providing supporting documents. So if the intention was always to argue that this was never a workers' compensation claim, then these documents should have been submitted by the claimant, not the receiver. It's his obligation to prove his claim here under the statute. And I would argue that he simply has not here. And I would also point out, because Mr. Sandberg made some type of policy arguments, that there's a countervailing policy in these, particularly these insolvent insurance receiverships, but in any receivership, where when one claimant doesn't provide all of the proof that it needs to with its proof of claim and then attempts to serially litigate it by supplementing and changing its arguments, which is what I would argue happened here, and we set that forth in our brief in some detail, it's really the other claimants that are paying for that. All of the claimants that turned in their claims with sufficient proof on time and were approved, because there's a limited estate here. And in this case, we anticipate it's going to be very limited. No one is going to get paid out anywhere close to a dollar. We're still fighting and trying to find some ways to change that, but based on what we know now, anywhere close to a dollar. And so every time we're forced to go back to the district court or forced to come to this court and address new arguments that could have been made with the proof of claim, it's the rest of the estate that's paying for that. And so I think the preservation arguments, while there's sort of one concern that says, well, they're a claimant and this insurance company went under and they got left out to dry, so did, you know, over 1,400 other claimants. And it's an unfortunate situation in the statute, and then the receiver in a specific case is tasked with trying to sort out an impossible situation where an insurance company can't pay all of its claims and strike the right balance. And in the claim determinations, the receiver strives for consistency. And when claims are made serially or in pieces, it makes that almost impossible, and it's the other claimants that ultimately pay for that. So we would ask that the court hold Mr. Hamale to the arguments presented to the receiver and presented to the district court, and I think based on that record, for all the reasons discussed, this court should affirm the district court. And if there are no further questions, I will turn it back over to Mr. Sandberg.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, 2 minutes and counting.
Yeah. Nope, 1 minute and 49 seconds.
Even better. Your Honor, thank you. Thank you, counsel. Okay, essentially, the Drew case is refuted on page 7 of the brief that was submitted in reply to that citation. That brief is in this record as of February 28, 2025. That deals with the Drew case. It's not even in this jurisdiction. This is an appeal from a specific order that relied on a 2022 determination that stated he was an employee and not an independent contractor, and he filed a comp claim. That's the scope of the appeal. Whoops, sorry. So all of the purpose of the receivership and the number of claims, all of that is valid, but it begs the question. The receiver had in its record and in this record on appeal the South Carolina judgment prior to the oral argument that resulted in the order that is being appealed here. So that evidence is in the record. It was not submitted afterwards. There was a supplemental claim that included it. In terms of the citation to the purpose of the receivership, I would point out under 696B, dot 420, 1B, and 1H, on its face, this claim is valid. And it is the burden of the receiver to prove that it isn't. And they haven't done that. Simply because a comp claim was filed, it doesn't mean that there is exposure or there has been exposure.
So his argument about not being able to utilize the default judgment in the receivership.
Once again, Your Honor, not...
Oh. He had indicated that pursuant to statute, you can't use the default judgment in the receivership.
Okay. Whether or not it's a default judgment or not, there is still a requirement. And we've all done prove-up judgments. You still have to prove your case. Mr. Januzzi and his local counsel had in hand proof that that was a valid case that was filed. The judgment is valid. It was not excluded because comp is an exclusive remedy. And sort of the angels dancing on the head of a pin in terms of interpreting the contract of insurance and cases from another state. Ultimately, this is a court of law and equity. The receiver had, prior to the hearing that resulted in Judge Alf's order, evidence that refutes specifically the basis of the denial of the claim. They should have disclosed it. And the record on appeal, it is what it is. We can look backwards, shoulda, coulda, woulda. We all know that now. So we submit, we ask that it be reversed and sent back down to Judge Mendoza, who I think is now in Department 27. Thank you for your patience. Thank you.
Thank you very much.